How does Christianity compare with Islam, Mormonism, skepticism, Buddhism, Scientology, Jehovah's Witnesses, and other world religions? You'll find answers in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, The Christian Difference. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or learn more about The Christian Difference at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, The Christian Difference.
The day I started to stop being a feminist was the day I saw, you know, the positive pregnancy test.
Now in the 21st century, if you want terrorism, you go to Islam. That's where you find it.
Sexuality and the practice of sexual intercourse implies commitment and fidelity.
We don't preach the gospel to people to make them comfortable with sin. We preach it to comfort them when they sin.
Radio operators, commercial and amateur alike, just love Issues Etc.
Of course, liberal Bible critics are equal opportunity when it comes to their skepticism about the Bible. They often single out a book that they believe to be low-hanging fruit. Gospel of John is one of those sometimes. Oh, they are criticizing Matthew, Mark, and Luke as well, but John is the outlier in some ways, and maybe that makes him vulnerable, or at least they think it makes him vulnerable to their liberal Bible criticisms. But is John's gospel really that vulnerable when people question when it was written, saying that it was written late, maybe even after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Do they have a leg to stand on? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Monday afternoon, January the 7th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about the authenticity of John's gospel with Shane Rosenthal of the White Horse Inn. Here in the first half hour or so, we'll talk with Eric Johnson of Mormonism Research Ministry about Mormon polygamists who have taken up residence in Missouri. It's not the first time that Mormons traveled to Missouri, believing it to be the promised land of some sort. We'll find out what that's all about. And then Pastor Brian Wolfmiller will be with us in hour two to introduce the book of the Bible, Jonah. He's a prophet, but it's also a story that has become the fodder of Sunday school. See what Jonah was really all about in hour two of Issues Etc. Feel free to join us over the next 2 hours with your questions and your comments. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback at issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc. And our listener comment line, open always to our beloved on-demand listeners, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about the authenticity of John's gospel, Shane Rosenthal, a regular guest. He's executive producer and host of the White Horse Inn during 2019, during Mike Horton's sabbatical. He's author of a column in the latest Modern Reformation magazine titled The Fourth Gospel, Authentic Artifact or Fake Reproduction. Shane, welcome back.
Hey, Todd. Good to be with you again.
You've been behind the scenes at the White Horse Inn for almost three decades producing the show. What's it like to be behind the microphone this year?
You know, it sounded like a good idea at first until I realized I like being the man behind the curtain pulling the strings, but now I have to, I just listen to what I've recorded and I think, did I make any sense? My tongue isn't working. I don't know if you've ever had days like that.
Every day. Yeah. Every single day. and the older I get doing this on a daily basis, the more times I find myself in exactly that position, wondering what went wrong between the brain and the tongue. Happens all the time.
Well, at least what I have the opportunity to edit the show. You know, we record a conversation and then I work and edit it. But the thing is, after, you know, listening to myself for an hour, I'm the producer editor, and I think, is there anything left here that I've edited? It's all on the floor.
Oh my good. Well, you're just giving people the best. That's how you look at it. You're just giving people the absolute best.
Yeah, the best is only 5 minutes worth. What do they get?
Turning to our subject for this afternoon, liberal Bible critics sometimes consider John's gospel to be kind of low-hanging fruit. They like to question its authenticity, and in particular, they like to question whether or not it was even written by an eyewitness. Why is this?
Well, there has been a long conversation about John's gospel in New Testament scholarship over the past couple hundred years, and John's gospel in particular has been sort of, as you say, put aside as maybe the least reliable. And part of this is that it has been perceived to be the latest of the Gospels and also the most highly developed. It has the highest Christology, New Testament scholars have argued. And when actually, you know, when you look at the text of John versus that of Mark, you know, you actually find the same kinds of things stated, just in different ways. For example, in the book of Mark, and when I bring up Mark here, it's due to the fact that most contemporary New Testament scholars end up arguing for what's called the Markan priority, that Mark is the earliest of the Gospels. And that's something that's relatively new. It's certainly not the position of the ancient church. The position of the ancient church is Matthew, then Mark, then Luke, then John. But so there is this idea that John is the latest of the Gospels, and it's the most highly developed. But again, as you go to Mark, you say, does it present Jesus as just a nice rabbi who, you know, was just teaching nice things? He was trying to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony, but then got himself crucified. That's not really what Mark presents, because he's there in that text, as well as Matthew and Luke, saying things like, you know, he's forgiving sins. And people say, but who can forgive sins but God alone? Well, so he's being presented as the son of David, the son of God, the son of God. That word comes, that phrase comes up 8 or 9 times in Matthew's gospel. Now, John's gospel is perhaps slightly, it's written differently. And I think it has this, this air of reflection. And it could be a reflective gospel. That doesn't necessarily mean it's a super late gospel. And that's something that, that we should all evaluate. One of the things that, that I've ran across lately, I've just been reading through the works of John A.T. Robinson, who is this really fascinating liberal New Testament scholar in the 70s, and I think he died in the 80s. And he wrote his famous book, Redating the New Testament, where he argued, a liberal scholar saying things like, you know, the Gospel of John doesn't have the marks of a super late gospel. It actually, he thought it was one of the earliest of the Gospels, and he challenged the Markan priority as a result of his work.
So is it even asserted by these liberal Bible critics that John isn't only late, although authored by a John, but perhaps pseudepigraphal, that is, written by someone who is kind of making stuff up as though he were the Apostle John or the eyewitness John?
Yeah, and that has been certainly was a claim maybe in held by the majority of New Testament scholars a century ago or so. You know, before the John Rylands fragment was discovered, there were many, many scholars who were saying things like, this is a very Greek gospel, especially with its emphasis on the Logos there at the beginning, which we're now finding out is actually a very Jewish idea. And that's, you know, this new scholarship of the Jewishness of John's gospel is really helping us to see John in his original context. But 100 years ago or so, people were saying things like the Gospel of John is this very, very, it actually comes about maybe in the mid-second century. That was when people like Rudolf Bultmann were dating the text until the John Rylands fragment was discovered. So that, you know, if this copy of John's gospel is dated to be, you know, 100 to 125, and it's found in Egypt, well, even Bultmann was forced to concede that this thing had to have been written by the early 80s. That's what the date that he settled on. So if it was, though, in the mid-second century, it had to be pseudepigrapha. It had to be what, you know, fan fiction. Because, you know, you can't have an eyewitness in, you know, 150 AD who was, you know, would have been able to have been around the time of Jesus. And so since that was the case, but the redating that has happened when that John Rylands fragment was found, I would think it was in the 20s or the 30s, it pushed the date earlier, but still a lot of scholars in our time think maybe the 80s or the 90s, and as such, it reflects not real history, but it's these later sources and traditions, maybe somewhat, maybe John is the source, maybe it's fictional. If you go, like I've done, to college campuses, the average view on the street or on the average college campus is that it is fiction. That's how people dismiss it. And what I'm trying to do in the article is to say, look, if you look closely at the words of this text and the evidence that it presents, this is eyewitness information, and he gives us clear little details that he knows what he's talking about, that he knows what Jerusalem is like, that he knows the geography, the topography, events of the period that match what we know of first century pre-70 AD Jerusalem.
Let's start with that last one, that the author is not only aware of, but seems to be very familiar with the geography and the layout of Jerusalem and other places in his gospel. Give us some examples, Shane.
Well, one of the things that I talk about in the book is, you know, whenever he's referring to geographical places, he's going from one area to the other. It's the right language. Like, he goes from Galilee down to Capernaum, this area that he's at. When he goes down, well, that's actually because Capernaum is there at the bottom. It's the basin of the lake. So he knows, you know, where he was, I think, in the area of Cana. That is a downward direction. Another example is the fact that he uses the word, the town named Bethsaida, rather than the later town named Julius. It turns out, if you do some work with Josephus, that name change happened about, what had to have happened before 34 AD, when this one guy, I think it was Philip the Tetrarch, one of the Herods, he dies in 34. Before he dies, he finishes this renovation work of this town, Bethsaida, and he changes the name to Julius in honor of one of the wives of the Caesars. And if you look at Josephus' writings, 16-something times, he refers to the town by that new name, Julius. He's writing between the 70s and the 90s. Only once does he mention the older town name, and that in the account of the name change. So the fact that all the gospel writers, including John, mentions the right name at the right time, you know, because it would have been Bethsaida between 28 and 30 when Jesus, you know, during Jesus' ministry. So it places it, they were aware of the right name at that time. But also what's interesting is they don't use the updated name. In other words, it kind of gives me evidence that it says to me that this wasn't written as late as Josephus was writing his material, when that newer name was now common.
There's also an event that kind of demarcates a lot of these things here, and that is with respect to Jerusalem, and it's mentioned in John's gospel and the other gospels, and that is the destruction of Jerusalem. Why is that so important as kind of a pin in the timeline that help us determine as best as we can when the author is writing about the things he's writing about?
Well, that was the main argument from John A.T. Robinson, the liberal scholar I mentioned. He was arguing, look, none of the Gospels or anywhere, and actually in the New Testament, you find the destruction of Jerusalem as a completed event. It's not hinted at. It's not mentioned in John's Gospel at all. What you do actually find in John's Gospel is this present tense language of things in Jerusalem. For example, if your listeners have a Bible handy or later on, look up John 5, 2, and 3, because there it says that Jesus is going to this area by the temple, by the sheep gate, this place of five porticos that's called Bethesda. And he says there is in Jerusalem this place of five porticos. It's present tense language. Think about the way you and I talk about the Twin Towers. We don't say there is in New York City this place called the Twin Towers. That would sound odd, but if you do find that kind of language on a plaque in a New York restaurant, you know, I love the Twin Towers. It's present. That present tense language might be indicative of the fact that the plaque was written before the fall of the Twin Towers in 2001. And so it's a helpful way to date the text. So one scholar by the name of Daniel Wallace has done some work into that. And he said, you know, some liberal scholars push back and say, well, maybe John is using a historical present, kind of the way you and I might say Paul writes in his epistle. You know, it's that the word writes, we don't say wrote. It's a way of, you know, presenting this in a more living in a dynamic way. But what Daniel Wallace said is that when he looked at that present tense language, particularly the word to be, the Greek word for to be, he found no instances anywhere in, you know, 400 something examples of that in the historical present. And he argues this is one of the best arguments for a pre-70 AD Gospel of John, because two things here. He is using the present tense language, and he's also describing things the way it later ended up being. We discovered, I mean, Josephus will say things like, you know, Jerusalem had become a plowed field. It looked like it was never inhabited when the Romans destroyed it. Well, so this stuff was covered over for centuries. It wasn't only uncovered archaeologically until sometime in the late 1800s. But you know what? They found it exactly as John described. There was a place that was a bath area with two sections, which, you know, when you looked at the porticos, there were five of them in total.
Just as John had said.
Exactly. So he had some kind of first century information or early eyewitness information here. He's purporting what he saw, and he claimed to be the eyewitness. He uses that eyewitness language everywhere. I've seen with my eyes this. I'm telling you is the truth. Well, what he describes here, and with regard to the geography, he seems to have been accurate about what he said.
Shane Rosenthal is our guest. We're talking about the authenticity of John's gospel on this Monday, January the 7th. We are talking about that, and when we come back, we're going to turn to the names of people that John gives us, and even when he doesn't give us someone's name, it's also significant. Stay tuned.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Concordia University Chicago's music programs will support your aspirations, whether you want to pursue a professional career in music or simply improve your skills. Experience a wide variety of musical learning and performance in a Christian environment. Auditions for music scholarships will be held February 9th, 16th, and 18th, open to both music majors and non-majors. Admitted students, register today by logging into connect.cuchicago.edu.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Shane Rosenthal is our guest from the White Horse, and we're talking about the authenticity of John's gospel. Shane, there's also evidence of John's authenticity and of him writing of contemporaneous events or near contemporaneous events in the names that he mentions. How does that work?
So one of the scholars that I just recently interviewed on this topic is Richard Bauckham. One of the books he's written that deals with this is two of them, actually. One is called The Testimony of the Beloved Disciple, and another is an updated volume that he just came out with last year, updated the Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. And in both those books, he does an evaluation of some of the names that we find in John's Gospel in particular. In one of the books, he talks about Nicodemus. The name Nicodemus is really interesting because, you know, it doesn't appear in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So if John is pseudepigrapha, it's one of these names that's being invented. It's because it would be a fictional addition to the story, right? Well, it turns out that, you know, he does a lot of work. Bauckham does a lot of this work with looking at other sources, and he finds that there actually was a very wealthy family where you have this repeating name of Nicodemus. And so he develops a family tree, as it were, and says that this is very, very credible that you would have a wealthy member of the Sanhedrin named Nicodemus, so that everybody, when John wrote his gospel, would know who you're talking about. Another thing that Bauckham does in Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, he interacts with this database of names that was put together by this Israeli scholar by the name of Tal Ilan. And this database has now like 3,000 names put together from any kind of names we have from historical individuals, whether they're from texts or from ossuaries. You know, if for example, if you have in the Gospel of Mark 14 references to Simon, you only count that as one if it's referring to Simon Peter. But then there's also Simon Magus, this other character in Acts. So that's another individual with the same name. So they put together all these names and count individuals, not just multiple accounts of the same person mentioned. And they came up with a database of something like 3,000 male names in ancient Palestine, give 100 years or so before and after the time of Jesus. And what Richard Bauckham did was he evaluated that compared to the names that we find in the Gospels and in the Book of Acts. And what's amazing is it does not look at all like this was written by someone inventing names. These are all the kinds of names, the names we find in the Gospels and the Acts look exactly like the list of names. In fact, most of the names we find in the top 10 names of that period are also the same ratio of names that we find in the Gospels and Acts. The most frequently used names, when you have multiple Judases, multiple Marys, they're the same. It's in the same ratio as the most popular names in that period. And so some people pushed back at Richard Bauckham by arguing, well, look, the Gospel writers were just trying to give the Gospels this idea of a realistic effect. And then he, in his latest edition, responds to that objection by saying, nobody knew what, if you live outside the area, for example, with the Gnostic Gospels, when they are writing 200 or 300 years later, they're removed in time and in geography. They may be written in Egypt. And when they mention new characters that weren't originally mentioned in the Gospels, they mention weird names, names that are not from that period. And he also says nobody would know the data from combining all the Gospels together, and they wouldn't know the ratios of what are the most popular names. Would you know the most popular names of your own generation, much less from 50 or 100 years ago? Or how about, would you be able to identify, if you're writing a pseudepigraphal fan fiction kind of story set in Egypt, how well would you do in terms of making up the names? You wouldn't do very well at that. So that's one of the arguments that I think gives this gospel, it's a way of authenticating this as real history.
There's also an argument from the anonymity of certain individuals in the Gospels and in John that, and you need to kind of walk us through it step by step, that also gives John this ring of truth.
Yeah, and this is one of the pieces of the puzzle that I have only recently discovered in the last few years, and I think it's really powerful because there are these places in which you have a person who's mentioned, but his name is not given. And then the question is, you know, various scholars talk about the fact that, you know, why is it that this character goes unmentioned? A good example of this could be Lazarus. You know, he's so important in John's gospel. Why is he not mentioned in Matthew, Mark, and Luke? Well, one of the arguments could be that it was they're protecting Lazarus because it does say there in John's gospel that the authorities wanted to kill him. And so nobody could tell his story, which was an important story to tell, because if you look at John's gospel, it's actually the account of his resurrection that caused the people to assemble there on Palm Sunday on that his triumphal entry. So that explains the crowds, but then why didn't the other gospel writers mention him? Well, that's one. So that one argument would be it's protecting the source. Another example is the scene we find in the Garden of Gethsemane, where you have this individual, one of the disciples, takes up a sword and he chops off the ear of one of the high priest's servants. And it's all anonymous in Matthew, Mark, and in Luke. If you're familiar with the story, you know that the identity is Peter, because that's revealed to us in John's gospel. And many New Testament scholars over the past 100-something years, I've been diving into this subject. It turns out that over the course of actually more than 100 years, lots of scholars have said the reason for the anonymity here is that, you know, Mark, and especially Mark, because Mark may be, you know, Peter's associate. That's the way church history describes this particular gospel. So they're written at a time when Peter was still, you know, he's being put in and out of jail if you read the book of Acts. And we're not going to add another thing that could be added to his rap sheet. He's being protected so that the story is told, but we're not revealing the name of the individual. John, however, might be written a little bit later in time. There was a period when Peter actually heads out of town at the Book of Acts, which doesn't actually even mention the place he went. It says Peter went to another place during the persecution of Herod. So it seems like he's being protected there as well, and that's probably the time which we want to say John was written, because he's no longer in Jerusalem, so we don't have to worry about that. It's that he is no longer needing protection.
So Peter, it is essentially said during the time of the writing of John's gospel, Peter is either in that place that is undisclosed or he's dead. Either way, he needs
exactly.
No protection.
One of the two. Exactly. And I think there's one possible place at the end of John's gospel, which may indicate that Peter was still alive when John's gospel was written. It actually, there's a place right there at the last chapter where there's a discussion about the relationship between the beloved disciple and Peter. And Peter is told by Jesus, you know, he said this to Peter to show by what kind of death, the narrator is saying, to show by what kind of death he will glorify God. It's not so easy to see in the English translations, but there in the Greek, it's in the future tense. And it's when you actually look at that phrase, it's repeating a phrase Jesus had talked about, what the narrator had talked about before applying to Jesus. He said this to speak of the way in which he would be crucified. So, but the tense is changed to this future tense. So it almost seems like there is, again, in chapter 21, I think around verse 19, that it's from the perspective of the narrator who is telling the story, Peter's death is still set in the future.
And you mentioned the beloved disciple. This is, I think, a strong point as well, that the author of John's gospel, if he were writing a piece of pseudepigrapha, he would probably want us to know his name and maybe might even pretend to be someone of importance in Jesus' inner circle, but John is strangely anonymous in his own gospel, isn't he?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that, whatever your view of the authorship, and I think that if you evaluate, and you know, most of the even conservative commentators, they talk about the fact that evidence can be marshaled one way or the other, but it's not a very clear thing. It's something you have to wrestle with the evidence, because it's nowhere clear. Do you see? As you do in the writings of the Apostle Paul, I, Paul, write to you this letter, etc. So what you have to do is look at the evidence. And what you'd find is frequent references to this beloved disciple, the disciple who was there, who leaned at Jesus' side, etc. At the very end of the gospel, you find that language of this beloved disciple, the one who leaned at Jesus' side, is the one who is reporting this witness material to you. But there's no name that's ever given there. Well, whether it's John the Apostle or another eyewitness, a person who was close to Jesus, whatever, however you come down on that, the key is that whoever wrote this didn't need to secure his authority in the way that a pseudepigraphal writer would. So why do you read the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Judas or the Gospel of Mary Magdalene? Notice all those have, you know, they're using the authority of a well-known disciple. But now what's happening here is this pseudo-gospel is using that authority to give you this new secret information. And when you look at that information, there aren't any of these geographical or historical clues. It's all this esoteric teaching that doesn't look like first century Jewish ideas. It looks like second or third century Gnostic ideas. So it's clearly pseudepigrapha. It's clearly fan fiction. And it's the way they secured the authorities by claiming to be new information by Thomas or Mary or Judas or whoever. Well, the Gospel of John, you know, you have that name Malchus mentioned there in chapter 18 that is not mentioned in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. Peter slays, you know, chops off Malchus's ear. Why does he bring that name in if he's inventing this story, embellishing the story? But he doesn't mention his own name, securing authority. It seems like whoever wrote this text had enough authority already and secured it by just reporting the facts as he saw them.
Finally, you use the analogy of the Antique Roadshow, where if we're going to care about the authenticity of these things, it cannot be one's nostalgia or sentiment or subjective reactions to texts like this. We need to be like those those curators in the Antique Roadshow and just kind of pay attention to the details? Why is that so important?
I love that analogy because if you've ever watched that show, you know, sometimes a person will bring in like a desk from that's supposedly it's been in their family for ages, but it supposedly sat in John Adams' house. And then the appraiser will do is they won't just take the story as it's received. They evaluate the artifact with all looking at all these little clues and looking at the wood and looking at the various manufacturer imprints, et cetera. And those little clues tell us the bigger story, which gives objective information, not just the subjective love or hate. Like, I hate this desk. It's always been in the family. It's in the garage. But when they're told this thing is actually worth $300,000, they say, maybe I don't hate it so much anymore. And I think that's where we need to do some more work in our churches, because what we have is a lot of people who like Jesus. They love the Bible. It's all about my subjective appreciation, love for this text, this Jesus who's reported in this text. But when you try to tell other people about this, they dismiss it. They say, you know, I don't like your Jesus. I don't like that text. So all we have is the love and the hate. But what if there were these objective criteria like you have on Antiques Roadshow? What if you could say, it doesn't really matter whether you love or hate the desk or the painting. What matters is it really true history? And if it's true history, then it's a treasure whether you like it or not. It's true whether you like it or not.
Shane Rosenthal is executive producer and host of the White Horse Inn in 2019 during Mike Horton's sabbatical. He is author of a column in the latest Modern Reformation magazine titled The Fourth Gospel, Authentic Artifact or Fake Reproduction. You can find out more about Modern Reformation magazine and the White Horse Inn at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Shane, thank you very much.
Hey, Todd, and also that article is also right there on the front page of the White Horse Inn website, whitehorsein.org. People can find it in the featured section.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
When we come back, we're going to talk with Eric Johnson of Mormonism Research Ministry about Mormon polygamists who are taking up residence in Missouri. Some people are going to assume that they're survivalists or that they're preppers. Some of them may be. What is it about Mormonism, their religion, that have them taking up not only residence in Missouri, but polygamy? Stay tuned.
Do you need a home mortgage, car, or student loan in 2019? Check out Lutheran Federal Credit Union. During January, when you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or when you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to their Ministry of the Month, Christ Community International. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran FCU, good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
The recent unprecedented decline in American Christianity has been well documented. But what can we as Lutherans do about it? This question is at the heart of the Lutheran Witness's January issue on missions and evangelism. Start to finish, readers will encounter faith, courage, conviction, and the assurance that, as Victor Raj puts it, in the church, ministry, and mission always go together. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
For 28 years, I had the privilege of serving as a chaplain in the United States Navy.
Dr. Dan Gard, retired Rear Admiral and President of Concordia University Chicago, on the need for military chaplains.
During that time, I was able to bring word and sacrament to so many young people and their families, our sons and daughters spread throughout the world. Truly a privilege and an honor, and today there are other chaplains that must follow. We need more LCMS chaplains in all branches of the military. It's an incredible, amazing mission opportunities to go to places no other pastor can go, but to go with the same tools that any other pastor brings wherever he goes, word and sacrament.
You can find out more about the vocation of military chaplain at lcms.org/armedforces. The LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces, lcms.org/armedforces.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you tired of working out at big box gyms? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Find out more at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. Performancefitness618.com.
The Substitute Organist Service has been a great blessing for our worship life here at Christ the King Lutheran in Riverview, Florida.
Pastor Kevin Yoakum on the Substitute Organist Service.
Now our organ plays rich liturgical music every single Sunday, and it's very affordable. You pick the hymns, you pick the liturgies. It's very simple. Just know when to push play.
You can find out more about the Substitute Organist Service at churchmusicsolutions.com. churchmusicsolutions.com.